Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to the Cigna Autism Awareness Series. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. To ask a question during the session, you'll need to press star 1 on your telephone. As a reminder, today's program is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's program, Joan Blackman. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for calling in to Cigna's Autism Awareness Series. This is Joan Blackman. I'm a care manager for the autism team at Cigna, and I just want to give a few logistics before we start the webinar. Because of the format of the call, you cannot ask questions during, but there will be time at the end of the webinar to ask some questions of our presenter. A handout for today's seminar is available at www.cigna.com/autism. You scroll to this month's seminar section, which is about the middle of the page, and then click on the blue Read the Handout. Again, that's at www.cigna.com/autism. Please note that not all policies cover everything in today's topic. For specific information on your policy, please contact Cigna's autism team with the number on the back of your card. Now, today I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Eric Enlich, PhD. He's a clinical psychologist and founder of Top College Consultants, helps students diagnosed with autism worldwide transition to college and graduate school. He is a frequent writer and national presenter on autism and college admissions. Dr. Enlich is on the clinical advisory board of the Asperger Autism Network. He's taught psychology at Tufts, Boston College, Suffolk University, and University of Massachusetts, Boston. We're very happy to have you here today, Dr. Enlich, and you can start whenever you're ready.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on the call, and thanks, everyone, for joining us. I'm going to refer to the slides as we go through them, but if you don't have access to the slides during the call, don't worry. Everything I say should be self-explanatory. The first slide just has my contact information, eric@topcollegeconsultants.com. Second slide just explains that I might mention specific programs, but I'm not promoting any particular program. I don't have any financial ties to programs. I get hired by families to find the best schools, colleges, programs for their kids. I may mention particular programs just as examples of the types of programs that may be of interest. And some background was already given about me, so I'm not going to go into any great detail on that. I'm a psychologist. I'm a college admissions consultant. And I'm also an autism dad, and I identify as being on the spectrum myself. And as far as I know, I'm the only person with that background doing this work who's also on the spectrum. So that being said, let's move along. I've got a quote here. Your development has to go at its own pace. It just doesn't happen to be the usual pace. And it's a quote from the book A Wrinkle in Time, which I happen to like. If you are looking for autism-friendly colleges and universities, I have a long list on my website, topcollegeconsultants.com, but otherwise I'm not going to promote my service. I think it's a helpful resource for folks. So why are we talking about this subject? Why is it important? Well, approximately 50,000 autistic students graduate high school every year in the U.S. At least a third of them enroll in college, probably closer to 50%. That's an old figure from a study a few years ago. More recent figures suggest that it's higher, but it's still not nearly as high as their peers. Approximately 75% of the general population of high school grads go on to college. And some studies on the subject suggest that most of the students on the spectrum who go on to college don't finish their degree. Again, we're still trying to get updated, accurate figures on that, but that is a source of concern that a lot of students who do go on to college don't actually finish. Even in the general population, only about 60% of college students have finished a degree after 6 years, but the numbers for students on the spectrum are unfortunately lower. And then in addition to that, only about 40% of those who actually disclose their diagnosis in college actually get any special services or accommodations. So it's not a given that if you go to college And if you report that you're on the spectrum, that you're automatically going to get accommodations and services. So it really matters kind of how you approach this. And then, of course, parents are also concerned about what happens after college. For a lot of folks, college is a potential gateway to a career. And the percentage of autistic youth who work for pay between high school and their early 20s is much lower than their peers. It's reportedly 58% between high school and early 20s versus 99% of non-autistic young people. And those who do work don't tend to earn very much on average. There's a lot of underemployment as well as unemployment. And again, we find that even when employees on the spectrum disclose their diagnosis, only about 40% of them actually get any accommodations at work. So the workplace can be a challenging place as well. So for all these reasons, it's a really important area to look into. And let's move on to the topic of college readiness, which I really spend a lot of time thinking about and working on with teens. Because there's an important distinction between being college capable and college ready. In other words, if you're a high school student who's getting pretty decent grades, maybe taking some challenging courses, doing well, whether it's in regular level courses or higher level courses like honors, AP, IB, dual enrollment, you might feel as a student or as a parent, my child is going to do just fine in college because they're doing great academically in high school. And they may, in fact, be capable of the academic level required in college. But being college capable is not the same as being college ready, because there are many, many other skills needed to thrive in college besides being able to handle the level of work. And so one of the most concise ways of describing what college readiness is, which I, courtesy of Jake Weld at Mansfield Hall, is that students need to independently identify when they need help in any area. So that means if they're struggling in a course, falling behind, they need to be aware of that themselves. They need to have that self-awareness that, oh, you know, I think I'm having trouble understanding what the professor's talking about, or I think my grades are slipping. Or it could be in a different area. It could be in the area of emotions that, you know, I think maybe my depression is coming back. So that independent identification that they need help, that self-awareness. And they need to independently seek out whatever supports and services they need to address that issue. So that might mean in the case of falling behind in a course that, you know, I think I better go and go to the tutoring center and see if I can get a tutor in this course. Or maybe I should go to the professor during office hours and talk about what I'm struggling with. So that's that sort of self-advocacy piece of seeking out services and supports and continuing to do that even if there's obstacles, even if you call up the tutoring center and nobody answers the phone, or if you go to the counseling center to meet with a counselor and they tell you there's a long wait. Means that you have to advocate for yourself and keep going and surmount those obstacles and not be easily discouraged. And then finally, you have to independently apply the supports that you've accessed. So it's not enough to just show up at the counseling center or the tutoring center or whatever the resources that you're seeking out. You have to actually use the resources that you've gotten and apply it to the challenge that you're having. It's not enough to just say, hey, I made an appointment, I showed up. You actually have to do something with those resources. So if you can identify when you need help, seek out services, and apply the supports that you've accessed, then you're probably ready for college. But that's a fairly tall order. On the next slide is to talk about how college differs from high school. And really one of the most striking differences is that in high school, much of your time is structured. Typical student in high school gets up early. Sometimes parents are waking up the student, rush off to school, hopefully have breakfast. They're in school for much of the day. Then after school, maybe they have a band practice or a sports practice or SAT prep. Maybe they just come home and play video games or do homework, have dinner, do some more homework. And before you know it, it's time to go to bed and do it all over again. So the days are pretty structured and pretty full in high school. It's quite different in college in that a student might have a whole day with no class at all, or they might have 2 or 3 hours of class the whole day and no parents around to tell them what they need to do next, to tell them that they need to come down for dinner or do their laundry or study, work on the paper that's due or anything else. So it's a lot, much less structure in college. And for students with executive function challenges, that is challenges with time management, organization, planning, avoiding procrastination, that's a huge challenge. And most students with ADHD, autism, similar profiles do have some executive function challenges. So that ability to organize and handle unstructured time is huge. And then in high school, there tend to be, for students who are on an IEP or a 504 who are getting special services, there's a lot of supports in place. The teachers, the parents, the high school counselor, learning specialists, special needs teachers. There's a lot of supports in high school. And in college, the students have to seek those supports out themselves. It doesn't just fall in their lap. So in college, you sign up for courses, and any other supports you want, you pretty much have to go out and find them yourself. Those supports are there. There's usually free peer tutoring available and free counseling available at the counseling center, and maybe a variety of other supports, disability accommodations, but it's up to the student to seek those out. None of that just happens automatically. In terms of the skills that students need in college, I alluded to before, self-awareness, self-advocacy, and I also think of it as self-management. So I'm not exactly following along the slide because my thinking on this is always evolving, and I find it helpful to break down these skills into those three areas. Self-awareness, that's kind of knowing what you're good at, knowing what you're not so good at, what you need help with. Self-advocacy, that's being able to seek out resources, make appointments for yourself, whether it's for your medical needs, your mental health needs, your academic needs. And self-management is things like managing your time, managing money, managing your reactions and your feelings to things, whether it's dealing with a roommate or dealing with a disappointment on the grade you got on the last test. Being able to manage yourself is really important. And I don't expect students to have all of these skills right out of the gate. Even neurotypical students who are not on the spectrum don't necessarily have 100% of these skills when they start college, but hopefully they have enough of them that they're going to be able to stay in college and thrive, or they at least know where to get help for those things if they don't have those skills. And that's really key, that if you are lacking in any of these areas, it's fine. There's lots of help out there, but you have to know where you need the help and you have to be willing to get it. And that's a challenge that I run into with students on the spectrum, with students with other special needs in high school as well, that often they look to college in sort of an idealized way, thinking, okay, finally I'll get away from this situation where I'm on an IEP and I'm a special ed student and I'm labeled and I'm treated differently. In college, I'll just be one of the gang and I'll make friends. It'll have kind of a mainstream life. Well, students can have a great experience in college, but the autism doesn't go away. And if they have executive function challenges or ADHD or other anxiety or depression as well, that doesn't just automatically vanish because they've gotten a high school diploma. So they need to be self-aware. They need to know what their challenges are and be willing to get the support in order to thrive. In the area of emotions, which I've referred to a couple of times, and it's of particular interest since I'm a clinical psychologist, it's important for students to know what are their vulnerabilities. I'm a student who, under stress, tends to start having panic attacks or tends to start to get depressed or use video games too much or isolate myself socially or drink more. Whatever those vulnerabilities are, you need to know what those are, what you're prone to. You need to know what the red flags are, that those things are starting to pop up again, So let's say if you're someone who's prone to depression, you need to know the red flags for you are that you're not going down to the dining hall, you're skipping meals, you're sleeping later, you're not getting online and playing games with your friends. Whatever those red flags are, you need to know what they are. And then you need to have some go-to strategies and supports to deal with them. So, and I'm not suggesting that it all has to come in the form of professional therapists or counselors. Your go-to strategy might be listening to music or going for a walk or talking to a friend. There's all kinds of things that people find helpful. Exercise is a big one for a lot of people, meditation or other meditative practices. There's no one right answer for everyone. And then, of course, you need to know what supports are available and be willing to access them. And as I mentioned, you know, typically in college, there's free counseling available. So that's a great resource, but by no means the only one. For some students, they also need medication or potentially other resources. So let's move on to the next slide about accommodations. I'm just going to go over that briefly. Don't want to spend too much time on that. So some students have had accommodations in high school of, say, extra time on tests or ability to take tests in a private room and so on. And those are accommodations that are often available for standardized tests such as the SAT and ACT. And if you're going to pursue those accommodations in the college admissions process, you want to get started early because you might be denied and you might need to appeal it. You want to identify the person at school, at the high school, who can help you with that. It's much harder if you try to do it completely on your own, not through the school. And ideally, you want those accommodations written into the high school education plan because it's going to be much easier to justify to ACT or the college board that you need accommodations if you've already shown that you've been getting those accommodations in high school. If you're saying for the first time, all of a sudden, hey, I need accommodations, but I have no track record of getting those accommodations, that's a harder case to make. And then finally, if you're a student who just doesn't do well on standardized tests, no worries. There's even before the pandemic, there were well over 1,000 test optional colleges, and there's even more now. So there's lots of options for students who don't test well. Let's move on to the next slide. That is accommodations in college. And this really works differently than it does in high school. So this is really important for students and parents to understand that nothing really happens automatically after college. There's no carryover of the IEP or 504. There's no automatic accommodations granted. Students have to reach out to the Office of Accessibility or Disabilities. There's lots of different names for them at different colleges. Sometimes it's Office of Student Success, Student Access, whatever they call it at your particular college. You need to reach out to them, make an appointment, bring documentation, show that you have a diagnosis, and talk about what accommodations you need and what accommodations and services they have available. Now, ideally, I would like to see families doing this in the college search process, not just after they've gotten into college or committed to a college, but actually when they're trying to decide what college to go to in the first place. And that's why on my website I have a list of autism-friendly colleges, because some colleges offer a lot more in the area of services and supports than others. Now, be aware that all colleges by federal law do provide accommodations for different kinds of disabilities, autism being just one, of course, of many different disabilities. And students have disabilities for physical or medical reasons. And colleges, just like workplaces, are required by law to make reasonable accommodations to allow students to succeed and thrive. And those accommodations can span a huge range, not just the ones that you might be familiar with, like extra time on a test, but an accommodation, just as an example, might be getting a single room in a residence hall because living with a roommate would be unduly stressful. And so these are great things to be talking about and researching while you're doing the college search. reaching out to disability offices, learning what they have to offer so that you can make a good comparison of colleges before the fact and not discover after you've committed to a college that they don't really have the supports that you need. So you can do research. I'm researching them all the time. I'm talking with disability folks. I'm in a normal year, I'm traveling to like 50 colleges and particularly the colleges that offer good supports to understand what they offer and how they differ. Some of these colleges want recent documentation in the form of a neuropsychological report. So that means the past 3 years, typically. Not all colleges, I don't want to speak for all colleges, but that would be a common sort of expectation. If you don't have that, but you have other documentation like an IEP, you bring whatever you have and have a conversation with them and see if that's going to meet their needs. Sometimes you can find that information on the website. In any case, they can tell you if you can't find it on their website. And a small number of colleges will help you get access to neuropsychological testing at a reduced fee. I have run across that occasionally, but it's not something I would take for granted. And there's also the question that comes up a lot is when do I disclose my diagnosis? And if so, when? Do I disclose it when I'm applying? Do I disclose it after I get in? I've actually addressed that in an online post. And it's a complicated question. The short answer is, you know, it's a very personal decision. I don't want to make a blanket statement for everyone. It does make sense, I think, to, if you haven't disclosed prior to getting in, that you do so after you get in. That again, reach out, make an appointment with the Disability Center and provide your paperwork, get the accommodations that you might need. I know that a lot of high school students have this attitude of, you know what, I think I'm going to be okay. I don't think I'm going to need that extra time in college. I think I'm more mature now. I've gotten better in my study habits, so I don't think I need all those accommodations anymore. Well, my feeling is if you have the documentation to support them, sign up, get all the accommodations you can that you might need. And if you don't need them, great. But if you do need them, you can't really get them retroactively. If you fail a test, you can't say to the professor, oh, well, it turns out I have a disability and I need extra time on that test that I already failed. It's too late at that point. Whereas if you have the accommodations in place and you start thinking that and you have extra time on the test, if you don't use it, that's fine. But if you have that available to you, then you have a little more leeway. And that's true, of course, for other kinds of accommodations too. I'm just using extra time as an example. And if you do choose to disclose your diagnosis in the college search process, if you go and make an appointment with the Disability Center, that shouldn't impact your admissions because it's a completely different department from admissions. They're not going to call up admissions and say, hey, we got this student coming in here inquiring and they have a disability and you should know about that. They're not going to report you. So you can have that conversation and do your research without fear that it's going to affect your admissions. And it shouldn't affect your admissions even if you disclose it on your college application. It shouldn't affect you adversely. And for some students that actually want to talk about it, on their application, and there may be situations where that's actually helpful. Let's say if a student had some period of time in high school where their grades were lower and then they went up, they might want to explain why that was. Maybe they went on medication that helped them with their moods or their attention, and it would be helpful for the admissions committee to understand, to make sense out of the transcript. So sometimes it makes sense to disclose. But again, it's a very personal decision. I don't want to imply that there's one answer for everybody. So let's move on to what are some of the paths after high school? And I break them down into a few different options here. One option, of course, is just to go to college like anybody else and not have any extra supports. And if you don't need those supports, then you probably aren't on this call in the first place. So I'm not going to spend any time talking about that. But of course, not all students on the spectrum need extra support. Some of them can do just fine. Then there's the option of not going to college, of course. I don't mean to suggest that all students need to go to college. Some go on to the military, or they get a job, or they get a certificate in IT field, information technology, or healthcare, like being a medical coder, or learn to do a trade like carpentry or plumbing. Well, of course, there's lots of other pathways, but we're here to talk about college. So let's focus on the other options. For students who have an intellectual disability and might not be capable of college level work, there's still an option for them to have a college experience in non-degree certificate programs. These are typically 2 years, some shorter, some longer, but the typical program is 2 years, and these are programs that don't lead to a degree, but they happen at a college campus, and they allow these students to have a college experience, to live in a residence hall, eat in the dining hall, but mostly they focus on life skills and career skills more so than academic areas. So that would be a non-degree certificate program. I'll speak a little more about those briefly in a little while. Then there's getting supports in between high school and college. So working on your college readiness before you get to college by taking a year off or more than a year. And I'll talk about some of those options. So that would be going to a gap year program, a transition, or college readiness program. Another option is to go to college and get supports from someone that you hire on your own. So you might have a reason that you want to go to a particular college because your family went there, or it's the nearest or least expensive college, or that college offers a particular course of study that you're really excited about. Well, for whatever reason, maybe your friends are going there. Sometimes kids are attached to going to a particular college for a particular reason, but that college doesn't offer extra supports for students on the spectrum. If your main challenges are executive function, study skills, procrastination, time management, there are companies and coaches that you can hire on your own separately to help you with that, no matter what college you happen to be in. Those services are typically provided virtually. So that's an option. The next option would be going to a college that has a built-in support program. And some of these programs are, and they have a variety of different names, are programs to help with academic skills, with learning, with executive function challenges. You'll meet with an academic coach who will often meet with you once or more than once a week, go over your assignments, help you, essentially kind of help you stay on top of things and make sure you get your work done and that you move along and graduate. And then there are some support programs that are even more specialized that are specific to autism. And the difference is the autism programs tend to have a social component because obviously lots of kids on the spectrum have challenges with social interactions. And so the autism programs tend to have social groups, social events, social skills, workshops, whereas the learning support programs that are not autism specific don't tend to have that piece. So if you don't need that, but you need help with the executive function skills, then it doesn't necessarily have to be an autism program per se. So that would be going to a college that has support programs. Again, I have some of them listed on my website, and I'm going to be talking about a couple of examples. And then the last category would be going to a college that is just for students with learning differences. And there's only two in the United States, so we'll come back to that shortly. And those colleges are exclusively focused on serving this population. So that's a highly specialized track. Moving on to the next slide. Don't see a number on the slide, but it says certificate programs in college settings. So again, those are non-degree programs. Those are for students who are not going to earn a degree. If students have mild intellectual disability and just are looking for help with vocational or employment training and want to have a college-like experience, they can be a good option. The next slide is an example, Project Forward, which has been around for a long time. It's in Cape Cod Community College in Massachusetts. It's a non-residential program, so students have to live in the area because there's no housing provided as part of the program. Next slide is a residential option, and again, a certificate program that's not a degree program, but that involves a residential component. And the advantage of a residential program is that it's more of a wraparound situation where students are more likely to get additional social skills and life skills support because they're there 24/7. By the same token, those programs, of course, are more expensive because you're paying for housing too. And on to the next slide, I give an example which is a threshold program also in Massachusetts. Led to the university, typically 2 years, although students can have additional connection to the program after they graduate. And those students can have the option to take some regular college courses, join some clubs, and so on. Let's move on to the degree-seeking options. Next slide is college readiness and transition programs. So sometimes these are a brief program of just a few weeks during the summer after a high school student graduates, but before they start college. Some of these summer programs are even open to high school students who are rising juniors. They don't even have to be, or rising seniors. They don't even have to have graduated. Or in a lot of cases, this would be a whole gap year, a whole year between high school and college. And this would be a year to work on organizational skills, social skills, life, independent living skills, budgeting, you name it. So lots of skills to help students adult, as they say. And next slide is an example of one, CIP, the College Internship Program, which has 5 locations across the country from California to Florida to Massachusetts. There's an independent living component where students are living in apartments. They may have an academic focus where they're taking some courses at a nearby community college or state college, private college, might have a career track focus where they're doing an internship. And there's support for the family too. So it's not just sort of dropping your kid off and waiting for them to finish the program. Families get support during this process too. Moving on to the next option, the next slide, and that would be to, again, attend a mainstream college and obtain outside support. So one example is Mansfield Hall. That's a very particular kind of model where students live at Mansfield Hall. It's like a dorm that's not on the college campus, and then they can go to any of the colleges located nearby. And Mansfield Hall has locations in Vermont, Wisconsin, and Oregon. So they've strategically placed their facilities in areas where there are multiple colleges, so students can live at the hall and then take college courses at a number of different colleges, depending on which one they get into, which one they prefer, and get a tremendous amount of support socially, academically, executive function, and so on at the house. So it's a very supportive communal environment. And it's a big additional expense on top of college. Then I mentioned the option to hire executive coaches on your own. There are companies that do that, like Beyond Booksmart or New Frontiers. I also know a number of folks individually who provide that service. And that would be where you would pay someone hourly to give you academic skills coaching or executive function skills coaching. And another example of a somewhat different model is Focus Collegiate, which is a new program in the Boston area where students can go to any college in the Boston area and get very intensive support from their coaches on really any challenges that they're running into in college. And that can range from academic to emotional challenges. And that started it. Although it's located in the Boston area because of the pandemic, it's now virtual like everything else these days, and they might be expanding to serve students nationwide. So kind of keep your eyes open for that. That might be an option for students anywhere in the country. Let's move on now to comprehensive programs located at the colleges. And this is, I think, of particular interest to a lot of families. Again, I mentioned that some of these programs are autism specific. Some of them are just sort of learning programs that might also serve students with related diagnoses, ADHD, and other learning differences. In some cases, there's a big additional cost for these programs on top of what you're already paying for college. And when I say big, I mean several thousand dollars a year, maybe $5,000 to $10,000 additional. There are some that don't have any additional charge. So the range of costs is quite substantial, and for the programs that I've listed, I actually break down the cost for all of them so you can compare and see, okay, how much is it going to cost if I want to go to this college and use this program? And I think that's a really important piece of information for families, which sometimes you can't even find on the college website itself. So that's why I put it on my list, because I think it's a key piece of information. And in many cases, you can get this support the whole time that you're in college. The autism programs, the autism support programs, have that social component, really important for students on the spectrum. And by going to a college that has a comprehensive support program, you're going to get more coordinated wraparound services than you would if you pieced together something on your own by hiring your own coach on the outside. So there's some great coaches out there. Don't mean to say anything negative about them, but if you go to a college that has its own program located in-house, they're going to know the procedures for registering for classes. They're going to know how the dorms work, how the dining halls work. So if there's any problem you're running into, they will understand the college system and be able to help you with every piece of it. And so one example of an academic support program is Lynn University in Boca Raton, Florida. I had the pleasure of visiting there at the beginning of the year before the pandemic. And they have a learning support program that has been around for almost 30 years, and about one in five students there is in the program. And I say that because when you've got that many students involved in the program, there tends to not really be a stigma to be going to the program. So it's important for students to realize when they're thinking about these programs that in many cases, and another example is Curry College, in many cases, you've got a lot of students using these programs. There's no stigma. It's very common. It's totally acceptable. And students shouldn't feel bad about getting the support they need to help them thrive and graduate. And the program at Lynn, they have academic coaches who are highly qualified, and they get frequent sessions of coaching and tutoring to succeed academically. But it's just academic support. An example of an autism support program, which would be specific for students on the spectrum, would be Drexel University in Philadelphia. And it's actually one of the few programs around costs that doesn't have an additional charge. Now, the university is not cheap, but at least you're not paying extra for the program. And Drexel's an urban university right in the middle of Philadelphia. Great opportunities for co-ops. They have created liaisons, relationships with a variety of companies that actively recruit employees or job applicants on the spectrum. So they really help with the transition to career and with career preparation. So that's a real strength of that particular program. And they have social skills component and peer mentors. And they actually have a whole autism institute at Drexel, so they know a lot about autism there. And finally, the last option that I had mentioned was specialized colleges that exclusively cater to students with learning differences such as autism or ADHD. And there's only two in the United States, Beacon College in Florida and Landmark College in Vermont. And I've been to both of them. They're fairly different, but they do have in common the fact that they're both small. And that, of course, has its pros and cons. It means sort of a more intimate environment where you're going to know everyone and everyone's going to know you, get a lot of hands-on personal attention. But it also means in a smaller college, you're not going to have as many majors available because they just don't have the student body to support as many majors. But the plus is that everyone, all the instructors, all the staff, is working exclusively with this population. So there's not going to be any stigma or any difficulty getting accommodations, getting supports. It's really baked in or built into the system. Beacon, if I recall correctly, all the students automatically get a single room, for example. Beacon also has both colleges actually have some substantial college readiness programs. So even if you're thinking, oh, I don't want to go to a college like that, you might want to look into them for the college readiness programs they offer. But again, those are just examples. There's loads of other college readiness programs out there, which I'm happy to help families explore. So that is kind of what I had to say in a nutshell, I suppose. And just to summarize, it's really important to figure out a student's college readiness, and I spend a lot of time with students trying to understand where they are in relation to college readiness. And if they're not rising seniors, if they're not about to graduate, you've still got time in high school to work on these skills, to get a student start waking themselves up in the morning and keeping track of their own homework and learning how to do laundry and all of those other skills they're going to need in college. You want students, and one of those skills is self-advocacy. It's a broad skill. It's a very, very important skill, not just in college, but in the workplace and in life. So that's something that students should be working on too. I'm sure if your student's on an IEP or 504, you've heard the term self-advocacy. And then finally, know what a student needs. Know whether a student needs an alternative to college. If they're not college capable, do they just need a transition program to be ready for college? Do they need a full autism support program in college where they can get a lot of wraparound supports? Or do they just need to go to any college and get minimal accommodations like extra time on tests? If you go to any random college and ask them what they have to offer for students with disabilities, they will go on and on talking about their accommodations, that they have text-to-speech technology, or they have the ability to give tests in quiet rooms, and so on and so forth. These are things that all colleges offer, and that may be all your student needs. And if so, then they can potentially go to any college they want. So that's about it. I'm going to turn it over and open it up to questions. I've got a slide there with contact information for me, and then one more slide. I guess it's slide 27. I didn't see the number before. Slide 27 is just a few resources. There's loads more resources out there, and I have resources on my website as well. I'm ready for questions.
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you'd like to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Also, as a side note, today's question and answer session will be anonymous. I will just simply announce you by your first name. Once again, if you have a question, please press star then one. I'm not showing any questions in the phone queue at this time. Oh, wait a minute. We're getting a question.
Okay.
Our question comes from Aretha. Your question, please.
I was just wondering, do you have any information regarding like scholarships for people on the spectrum?
Great question. Scholarships for people on the spectrum. So I'm going to answer that in a broader sense of scholarships in general. If you Google, you know, scholarships for autism, you will find some. They do exist, but scholarships is a complicated topic, and it's one of the things I work with families on, kind of finding the best options for them financially. Usually, your best source of money to start with is the college, is getting financial aid through the college that you're applying to. There's two kinds of financial aid. There's need-based aid, which is based around your financial situation. And then there's merit aid, which in theory has more to do with students' grades, test scores, and other qualifications. Sometimes there's interviews or essays involved to get merit aid. And those sources of funding are usually your best bet to start with. And, of course, families also do other things like take out loans. After that, the next best source, in my opinion, is getting scholarships locally because there's less competition for them. And your high school counselor can often help direct you to some of the local resources. And some of those scholarships might be autism related. There might be autism support programs or autism related nonprofits in your area that have money for scholarships or that would consider it if you reached out to them. So those local organizations, I think, are the next best thing for getting scholarships. Once you get beyond those two sources, You're often talking about national competitive scholarships. And again, if you Google, you know, scholarships and autism, you will find some. Often once you sort of get through all the fine print, you find that a lot of them don't apply to your particular case, or they've already, the deadline's passed or whatever. So you probably won't find that many once you kind of drill down into the details. And then even if you do, those, you're going to have kids all over the country or maybe even internationally competing for the same scholarships. So those are really a long shot. They do exist, but you can't really count on them to fund your college education. Plus, typical scholarships, whether they're local or national, are often modest. You know, $500, $1,000, $2,000. It's nothing to sneeze at, but it's not even going to pay for one semester at most colleges. So that's why I say it's not really in the same league as the kind of financial aid that you might get through the college itself. And also, another wrinkle that families aren't always aware of is that not all colleges allow you to stack scholarship money, meaning that even if you are lucky enough to get some huge scholarship, maybe it's $10,000 from some outside source, and maybe you're getting a $20,000 scholarship through the college. Well, some scholarships will just reduce the award they give you by the amount you got on the outside, so you actually haven't made any net gain, so to speak, that you might really not have done all that work getting that scholarship for nothing because you just ended up getting less financial aid from the college. Not all colleges work that way. That's why you have to kind of learn the differences between the colleges and find out, hey, does this particular college allow me to stack scholarships? Some do, in which case that extra money really comes in handy. So that's my answer.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Once again, if you have a question at this time, please press star then one. And I'm not showing any further questions in the queue at this time.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you to everyone for attending, and thank you, Dr. Enlich, for excellent.
Oh, pardon me.
Go ahead.
Did just get one additional question if you'd like to take it.
Sure. Yep.
All right. Our question comes from Alvin. Your question, please.
Yes. I have a student who's on the spectrum, my son, and, you know, he's, you know, centrally focused in certain areas. Can that be a benefit in terms of, you know, finding a specific college to, you know, address not only his sort of expertise in one area, but also where he doesn't have, you know, or, you know, is not working in those other areas, but, you know, a very centrally focused student who's, you know, that's sometimes a quality you see in a lot of students on the spectrum, you
mm-hmm.
know, where history is everything. I can tell you everything about the Constitution or
yes.
whatever.
Yeah. Great question about what to do for students with a very focused interest. So that is a core feature of autism, that sort of narrow or restricted interests. It's described in the diagnostic manuals in kind of a negative way. I don't see it as a negative. I just see it as those of us on the spectrum are wired differently. Our brains are more narrowly
yeah.
focused. And that can be a huge benefit for me. Some of my special interests include autism in college. So I can talk about it all day long. And we didn't actually talk about the features of autism so much in this particular talk. But you make an excellent point. So students with restricted interests, students with a specialized focus, have that particular presentation. And in high school, that doesn't tend to work so well because in high school, you have to take all these different courses.
Everything.
You have to take a foreign language, whether you like it or not. You have to take English, whether you like it or not. Colleges, each sort of, they're each their own entities, and particularly private colleges can, to a large extent, kind of call their own shots. So there's a huge variety. There are absolutely lots of colleges out there that have extensive distribution of core requirements or general education requirements, gen ed, some people call them, where you come in and you have to take a whole bunch of courses the first couple of years before you hardly even get to dive into your major. But that's not true of all colleges. There are colleges that are more so-called open curriculum, where there are very few restrictions and where students can, to some extent, take pretty much whatever they want. Now, this is on a range, so I don't mean to present it as black or white, but some colleges have much more flexibility, where if you love history, you can mostly take history courses. Usually there's still a couple of requirements. You might be a freshman English or writing course, but some colleges have minimal requirements, which would be a really good option for a student who says, yeah, I'll go to college, but I only want to study history. In general, I would say college is better suited in that respect, because in college you can dive into your major in any college, and not just the colleges with open curricula, but in any college, you have that opportunity to go into that major in tremendous depth and take 8, 12, 15 courses in that subject and really go into great depth. So I think in some ways it's a real plus in college and even more in grad school. So if you're a student who's cut out to go to grad school, by the time you go to grad school, you are studying nothing but the subject of interest. There's no other requirements in grad school. If you're a history grad student, you just do history. So I think in some ways it's an advantage.
Yeah.
But it would be a consideration when you're looking at, you know, how many other requirements are there at this college, and is my kid going to be okay with taking, you know, a foreign language class and a math class and all this other stuff in college all over again? Not all colleges require that, but some do.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And I'm not showing any further questions at this time.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Dr. Enlich. That was an excellent presentation. A
My
lot
pleasure.
Of great information. Thank you very much. And thanks for everyone who attended. And be sure to join us August 13th. Our next discussion will be Heather Hackett-Hayes speaking on compliance training. And hope everyone has a wonderful day.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your participation in today's conference. This does conclude the program. You may now disconnect. Good day.